on ABC Radio.
This is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Ahoy! Welcome aboard. First Cast is with brilliant pelagic fish expert Dr. Julian Pepperell about the epic yellowfin run off the New South Wales coast this year that has the Blue Water Brigade frothing. I believe they're on the mid-north and north coast as well as we speak. We'll find out from Julian. He's got plenty of eyes when it comes to the ocean and the grapevine. Julian has some amazing insight into these big, beautiful fish as well from a biological point of view. Stinker has been on the water with a crew from Port Macquarie, and we'll find out what they've been up to. And we'll have a look at what's in Santa's tackle sack for the keen angler this Christmas as well, and get some Ausfish news from David Witham, all coming up on The Big Fish. There's gold out there off the coast for our big fish listeners if they're brave enough and smart enough and prepared enough and safe enough to chase it. Dr. Julian Pepperell is an expert in pelagic fish and loves the giant creatures of the deep like the yellowfin tuna. Good morning, Julian. Welcome back to The Big Fish.
Yeah, morning, Scott. I like the music. Gold suits yellowfin tuna very well.
Aren't they a gorgeous looking fish, Julian? You've done a lot of work, a lot of tagging, a lot of citizen science, which has really proven to be gold when it comes to understanding these fish, although you were saying they're still quite an enigma.
Yeah, yellowfin tuna off the east coast of Australia and mostly off the southeast coast of Australia are difficult to work out scientifically. Over the years, there's been quite a lot of research done. The tagging program in particular, where recreational anglers tag tuna and marlin, has shown that the numbers fluctuate a lot, and we don't quite know why, and that's a long story. But the first yellowfin tuna that was verified caught off eastern Australia was caught off Bermagui by Zane Grey in the 1930s. So he kind of put that on the map. And since then, yellowfin they became a mainstay of the recreational game fish fishery off, well, from, say, Port Stephens down to the Victorian border. But in recent years, maybe the last decade, the numbers seem to have dropped off quite a lot inshore, but they're still caught out wide, and we think that they're kind of different groups of fish. They are, like you say, enigmatic.
Amazing. And of course, you were one of the people who wrote the foreword for Vicky Hastrich's amazing book about Zane Grey, which is a ripping yarn. It's a terrific read. And it was launched in the Sydney Game Fishing Club at Watson's Bay to a full house on the water on a stormy night. It's like we're at sea. And on the wall, of course, you've got Bob and Dolly Dyer's record yellowfin, beautifully preserved in casts, haven't you?
Yeah, well, there's another historic example, you're quite right. And Bob Dyer, of course, did pioneer a fair bit of techniques of game fishing off Sydney in his day. And yeah, those two casts are still there. They're no longer the records. I think they're in there like 45 kilos or something like that. His was a bit bigger than hers. But I believe they were caught at the peak. I might be wrong, but there's a submarine kind of small hill mountain off Sydney, still inside the continental shelf. And that was an area that became really popular for fishing, specifically for yellowfin tuna, also kingfish, of course, yellowtail kingfish. But the yellowfin tuna used to aggregate there, and it was not uncommon, apparently, to go out in the 1960s in particular and into the 70s and burley or chum for yellowfin by cubing. They used to call it cubing, and they would chop up, you know, small fish like pilchards and put those out in a trail and then put a hook in one of the little clumps of fish and get a hook up. And, some of the old timers will tell you that they were catching, they might catch 20 or 30 in a day. And I remember when I started game fishing, well, research game fishing, when I joined the fisheries department in New South Wales in the 1970s into the 80s, it was not, most people who went out of Sydney or anywhere off southern New South Wales, you would troll small lures. We used to call them Christmas trees, a little tinsel on the backs of them. You don't see them around too much now. And you catch a lot of skipjack tuna, but you would almost invariably catch small yellowfin tuna, less than 10 kilograms, and they were what we call school yellowfin tuna. And they're the ones that seem to have vanished from the fishery. They're obviously still out there somewhere because the yellowfin tuna stocks of the southwestern Pacific are not regarded as being overfished, even though well over 400, 500,000 tonnes of yellowfin tuna are caught every year in the southwestern Pacific, mostly around the Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea, and most of them are relatively small fish caught in purse seine nets. So there's something weird going on with these smaller fish that used to come in onto the continental shelf, and we tagged a lot of them and in those days, and found that they, once they, the tagged ones anyway, once they were on the continental shelf, they would move north and south. From the recaptures, we would find recaptures over the next 1 or 2 years of those fish that retained their tags. But then the tag numbers being returned would decline, and that was because we think that the yellowfin tuna, once they reach about 30 or 40 kilograms, they're adult, and then they go off to spawn in the tropics.
Amazing stuff. So there's still some pieces of the puzzle to be put in place. It's the big fish with Dr. Julian Pepperell, who loves his pelagic fish. He's a fish expert, a marine scientist. And Julian, that fish that Zane Grey caught in 1936 that showed people that they were a great sporting species was around 40 kilos. That is in the old weights, what's 100 pound or something? I don't know. Yeah. And that's just pretty normal, is it? How big can they get?
Well, that's another enigmatic issue with the yellowfin. The 100-kilogram yellowfin tuna off New South Wales was always regarded as the goal, and not that many anglers caught 100-kilogram yellowfin tuna. If they did, they would tend to be fishing around Montague Island off Bermagui, and there seemed to be possibly kind of like a resident population of these bigger fish. And a yellowfin tuna of about 100 kilograms would be around about 10 years old. And so we know that from ageing. But the record yellowfin tuna caught off New South Wales was 124 kilograms. And that was probably, 30 years ago. And we managed to get the otoliths, the ear bones, out of that fish, and they were sent to CSIRO in Tasmania for ageing. And that fish was 13 years old, and it weighed 124 kilograms. That's the biggest ever caught off Australian waters by recreational anglers anyway. But interestingly enough, yellowfin tuna occur right across the Pacific, and in fact the Atlantic Ocean as well. They're worldwide. And off California, there's sport fishing boats go out for days at a time. They're big boats, and they take 20 or 30 anglers out. And they fish with game fishing gear off the decks of these boats for yellowfin tuna around islands off Mexico, actually. So they go into Mexican waters and go out 100 miles. And there's these various islands that hold yellowfin tuna. But those yellowfin tuna are enormous. I haven't got it in front of me, but the world record that was caught in that fishery, and they weigh, I think, something like 450 pounds, but you convert that over 200 kilograms. Yeah, they're huge. But interestingly, they don't have the big, long sickles, they call them.
The sickle fins.
The sickle fins, which are the second dorsal fin and the anal fin underneath. So if you look at a yellowfin tuna from the side, it has these great big sweeping beautiful yellow fins, which no other tuna has, which is a weird thing too. But yellowfin tuna develop these, and they look a bit unwieldy when they're swimming. They sort of flap around like ribbons, and we don't really know what the purpose of those is either. And like I say, other tuna species that are closely related don't have them. But then these fish off the Mexican islands don't develop those fins. Interestingly, off New South Wales, I had a colleague, John Diplock, who New South Wales Fisheries did his Master of Science on yellowfin tuna, and he measured these sickles on offshore fish caught by the longline fishery, the commercial fishery, that were way out off the shelf, and the inshore fish that were being landed at tournaments. And fish of the same size, inshore and offshore, would have different length sickles. In other words, the oceanic fish had really long sickles, and the inshore fish of the same size had shorter sickles. And we think that this is not so much genetic, but once those smaller fish had come in on the continental shelf, for some reason they'll grow, but they won't develop the sickles. Why is just a mystery.
Could the other fish be nipping at them? I don't know.
No. There was no evidence of damage or anything like that. It's just yellowfin tuna. There have been studies done on the shapes of yellowfin tuna right around the Pacific basin, if you like, the Pacific Rim. And it does seem that they do have different body shapes in different areas. And so, you know, scientists were thinking we might be able to work out where they came from just by looking at their body shape. And now, of course, you can look at genetics. And it turns out that the genetics, the DNA of yellowfin tuna is highly mixed, and it doesn't seem that yellowfin tuna formed subpopulations around the Pacific, even though the tagging programs have shown, and by tagging many thousands and thousands of yellowfin tuna, that they don't tend to move really long distances on average. There have been recaptures of yellowfin tuna tagged off New South Wales that have been recaptured, you know, throughout the southwestern Pacific, maybe as far as Fiji, those sorts of Samoa, and Papua New Guinea, but not further than that. Whereas marlin, black marlin and blue marlin in particular, have average movements are much greater. I think the statistics on tagged yellowfin tuna over a long period of time is that it's highly unlikely that a yellowfin will move more than about 600 miles, nautical miles, from where it was tagged. So in other words, the great majority of them are recaptured much shorter distances than 600 miles. So they seem to form these groups, but then individuals must be moving around over bigger distances and breeding, or else the larvae of the yellowfin are moving big distances, and so that the genetics and the genes are being mixed up.
It's The Big Fish with Dr. Julian Pepperell on the yellowfin run, which has been epic on the south coast, and now they're starting to turn up further north, but everyone on the south coast who fishes just about seems to have caught at least one over 20 kilos, and no doubt they're all having sashimi for breakfast listening to this, having sashimi for lunch, and having seared tuna for dinner, and it's on the menu for the next 6 months because they're huge fish. And they're beautiful eating if you know how to prepare them properly. In the old days, we really didn't have that ability. Now that we share those culinary secrets with the Japanese, who know only too well how to handle and prepare these fish, then we're enjoying them more and more. But on the south coast, Julian, fish around the 20 to 30, 40 kilo mark, the odd one up to 60, were about. And in big numbers, big bust-ups too, you know, chasing the garfish or the souries or whatever they were, you know, whatever bait was on, they were balling it up. And some magnificent sights, lots of people talking about seeing these giant barrels of fish, you know, up to 100 pound, taking off like Exocet missiles with, you know, with the prey in their eyes. It's just an incredible thing to see out wide. And often there are the dolphins and the other critters in there as well. You know, I think the tuna are like the sheepdog of the sea. They round them up and then everything has a crack.
Yeah, and this is like the good old days in many ways, in that these are the stories, and I saw this with my own eyes. You know, I mentioned Montague Island. Well, it was not uncommon to see these big yellowfin tuna come, like you say, hurtling out from underneath the bait fish schools. And they usually were sauries, you know, S-A-U-R-I-E-S, sort of related to garfish, but they're oceanic. And and again, you know, pelagic fish are very much, you know, kind of dependent on where the bait fish are. They'll follow the bait fish. So in recreational fishing, boats only have a relatively small radius that they can fish out to sea, whereas commercial boats can go looking for these pelagic fish over much wider areas. And so when the recreational fishery sees these yellowfin tuna, it's basically because the bait, for some reason, the bait fish have come in closer. It's a bit similar with southern bluefin tuna in Victoria, where these really big barrel, you know, 100 kilo plus southern bluefin tuna have been, over the last, again, maybe 10 years, have appeared when before there was very few of being caught. And now there's lots and lots of them coming in close to shore. Now, we don't know why that is, but it's certainly partly because the bait fish are coming in close to shore. So whether there's been regime shift in the, it might be climate related, it might be just long-term trends over a long period of time, decadal sort of scales of time that dictate when bait fish will be prevalent or not. And these are usually not predictable. They're usually just what we call stochastic, which means unpredictable. But the ocean's produced lots of plankton in some years and not in other years, and so the whole thing is quite difficult to predict. But usually, if you do find a whole bunch of small fish, and in this case, the small yellowfin that would come in on the shelf in the past, you would know that would be a good couple of years, and for the next couple of years on bigger fish each year. We've been studying these sorts of fish for a long time. When I say we, myself and lots of other scientists, not just in Australia but around the world, and it kind of seems the more you find out, the more question marks remain.
It's amazing. Well, we do know something about their favourite tucker, because it's also a favourite food at this time of year in Japan. We're speaking with Julian Pepperell about the yellowfin, and just talking to a friend of the big fish, Dogfish Dave, who's just back from another trip to Japan. And a few years back when he was there, he gave us a live report from the Sori or Sanma festivals in the autumn, celebrating the Pacific Sori, a fish highly valued as a seasonal delicacy. The festivals are held in places like Tokyo's Meguro and Shinagawa and also Hokkaido. And the Soris are plentiful at this time of year. It's a seasonable food. It's called the knife festival, because the fish itself reminds them the autumn knife fish, with silver body and its shape. And they have all these festivals where they grill them and feed them up. So the yellowfin think they're good tucker, and so do the Japanese people. I don't think we've really got much of a market for them, have we?
No, not really. They're not really caught commercially off in our waters, although, if there was a market for them, I guess, some commercial enterprises might fish for them. But they're probably too intermittent in our waters and too unpredictable. But yes, in Japan, there's a number of fisheries like that concentrate on the smaller fish, soris, scads, and flying fish too, that have flying fish seasons as well, where they catch them in large numbers. And they're all beautiful to eat. And of course, the Japanese look after their fish really well. And but in Australia, the soris are so intermittent, and yellowfin tuna will definitely feed on those and obviously prefer them when they're abundant, because they're full of oil and obviously they fatten up on those.
That must be why the Japanese love grilling them, because in Hokkaido they have the festival of all you can eat charcoal grill fatty sori, toro sanma, and you just sit around and eat as many as you can that are grilled, so they'd stay nice and moist, wouldn't they?
My mouth's watering.
Yes.
And the other thing is that a lot of the soris that they catch over there are in spawning condition. And so the roe of the soris is a great delicacy as well, So it is a great fish-eating nation. We don't tend to exploit the resources the way that the Japanese do. But, in having said that, the Japanese manage their fisheries pretty well. And but the average amount of seafood eaten in Japan per person is a lot more than in Australia. But I was going to mention the diet of yellowfin tuna. So yes, when they're feeding on soris, if you open their stomach, they'd be full of soris. But a study was done by some New South Wales fisheries colleagues back in the 1980s on yellowfin tuna stomachs off New South Wales. But at tournaments, we would open up their stomachs and look at what they were eating, and we would find pretty well everything that you could think of that was out there. So that they're what we call opportunistic feeders. Most of the pelagic fish take the opportunity, opportunistic, to eat what's around, and if there's a schooling fish, well, that's easier to catch. But what we found was a lot of what you might call bycatch of trawling. Fish trawling was very prevalent in New South Wales back then for gemfish and redfish and tiger flathead and that sort of thing. And when they were sorting their catch, the boats were coming back and they, you know, throw back the what they call trash fish. Not a very pleasant term, but, you know, this was fish that was discarded. And it was not uncommon for yellowfin tuna to be following those boats in schools. And because when we opened the stomachs, we found a lot of the fish that were probably discarded by trawlers because they were kind of living on the bottom and not what you'd expect pelagic fish to be eating. And that's a possible reason why yellowfin tuna now don't occur inshore so much at all off southern New South Wales, because that fishery has really declined, if not collapsed, and it's a shadow of its former self. So it's quite possible that these boats coming back all the time with the discarded fish, a big trail of it, were attracting the yellowfin tuna onto the continental shelf, and they were staying there once they got there. And once the fishery declined, then there was nothing to follow. So yellowfin tuna remained out wide. It's a theory, but it's probably a pretty good one.
Yeah, that's a fantastic theory and fantastic depth of knowledge on these beautiful fish. Thanks for sharing it with us on The Big Fish. Just finally, you've got a few on the grapevine. I know you've got a network of game and offshore fishos up and down the coast. You're in southeastern Queensland, beautiful Maroochydore area, but are they starting to show up around Coffs, as the grapevine was suggesting last week?
Yes, I put the call into a good friend of mine, actually the ex-editor of Modern Fishing magazine, this is Glenn Booth, and when Glenn was the editor for 20 years, I wrote a column in every issue of every month in Modern Fishing for 20 years, and so I've got to know Glenn very well. He's retired now at Coffs Harbour and got his own nice boat that he goes out quite regularly fishing for marlin and yellowfin and other species, and yes, he said that the yellowfin have turned up there, and they're about 30, 40 kilos. And he went out yesterday, in fact, and he hooked up a couple of them and caught one. And he also, unfortunately, lost a blue marlin. He's a blue marlin aficionado, but he was very happy to have a fresh yellowfin tuna coming in, and he would definitely know how to bleed it properly and look after it, and he'd be eating sashimi, but like you say, the next week, I think.
Great stuff. Well, our Coffs Coast correspondent, Kendall Kramer, is keen to get out and get one, so that's getting her fired up. Hopefully we'll have a report from her next week that she's been able to boat one as well and break that duck. Julian, it's wonderful the knowledge that you've collected with the help of our game fishing and offshore fishing fleet. Thanks for joining us on the program.
It's been a pleasure, Scott. Cheers.
Always good to catch up with the amazing Dr. Julian Pepperell, fish biologist, on The Big Fish.
There's a singing single, a sell in celebrity. There's a rage in marriage. There's a grave in gravy. There's a dump in dumpling. A liver in delivery. There's a pay in every patriot. And a spit in hospitality. But there's a tuna. There's a tuna. There's a tuna in every opportunity. Trunk light or Abercore, guess who's knocking at your door? It's the tuna of opportunity.
All right.
If you take the two A's out of aardvark, if you take the two L's out of llama, if you take the two O's out of ooze, put them all together, they spell hello. But there's a tuna. There's a tuna. There's a tuna in every opportunity. Chunk light or Abacore, guess who's knocking at your door? It's the tuna of opportunity. There's a dye in every diet. There's a gas in gastrointestinal tract. There's a man in mental illness. And ovary and overreact. Yes, there's a tuna. There's a tuna. There's a tuna in every opportunity. Chunk light or Abacore, guess who's knocking at your door? It's the tuna of opportunity. Oh, water, oil, or ahi, you should give it a try. the tuna of opportunity.
Get out of it, bloody seagulls.
On ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
Here comes Stinker with his fishing tips. Some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find them? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
Morning, Stinker.
Hey, g'day, Scott.
Now, folks, Stinker's been at sea for 2 days this week, and he hasn't been fishing, but he's been talking. How are you, mate?
Oh, good. I might be a bit croaky today because, oh, gee, I've had two wonderful days on the water. On Wednesday, I spent the whole day on Broughton Island. And then on Thursday, I went on another cruise up into the West Harbour, which is from Soldiers Point, way back up behind Karua, and the fascinating country at the back of Port Stephens. The reason I didn't go fishing is because they were history tours, and I'm the one that gives the spiel. I do all the talking. That's why I'm a bit croaky today. And because I'm into local history, as keen as I am on fishing, I love local history, and I learn all the time. And because I've written all those books, Scott, when you write a book, you learn a lot. And it normally takes me 3 years to write a book. One book, The Oyster Man, took me 4 years to write. And in that period, I interview sometimes 50 families. And, gee, you learn a lot when you do that. You go into the house and sit around the table. And then they bring out the family album. And then you record their stories. And then take copies of the old photos. And then you've got a book. That's what I've been doing for years.
I bet the memories come flooding back when you're on the river tour with all the people there, and you see a lease or you see a shed, and it reminds you of that research, those beautiful people and those stories.
Oh, it does. The first trip to Broughton Island, that was on Wednesday. As soon as I get over there, you can sort of smell the history. It's really got a magnificent history going way back, of course, to the Aboriginal people. And I was part of an archaeological dig there last year. And we unearthed some incredible stuff, evidence of Aboriginal people, the Warramai folk. So I'm very interested in that as well. And, of course, then, following the Aboriginal people were Chinese and Italians and Greeks and French and Europeans, all on the island. And they all left a mark of some sort. So you can sort of relay that to all the travellers, all the passengers, and they're fascinated by it as well. But the day on the water on Thursday that we went up to West Harbour, but you can't stop thinking about fish. When you were up there, and I'm talking about the history of places like Lemon Tree Passage and Oyster Cove and Tarlee and Carrington and Karua and Pindyma, they're all little places. Oh, Karua's quite a substantial town, but the others are only little pokey places, but they've got fantastic history.
And what about questions, Stinker? Do you get any fisher folk on board? Because they're probably asking you about what you can catch.
Exactly. They say, oh, well, the history's nice, but what can you catch? That's true. And, of course, when we're on Broughton, we all talk about snapper. And, there's a good spot. And I don't mind sharing my spots. Gosh, they're not my spots anyway. I'm just use them for a few days a year. And I know the good spots, so I just say, look, if you want to catch a fish, that's where. Go and drop your anchor there, and this is how you do it. You wait for a northeast wind if you're going to fish Cod Rock. You drop there just an hour and a half before sundown, and if you haven't caught a fish by the time the sun sets behind the Bulladealer Ranges, well, pack up and go home. But it's never happened to me that I haven't caught one because, well, you were there and watching. And the snapper hit pretty much on time. So that's on Broughton Island. That's in a nor'easter. If there's a southerly blowing, you just go on the other side of the island and fish in close to with the North Rock, which is on the north side of Broughton Island, and you do the same thing. So it's no big deal. It's quite a simple simple philosophy. Is just be there at the right time and you'll catch them.
Yeah, the great variety of habitat for fish too, you know, out there in the blue water out, way out at sea at Broughton, and then way up in the mangroves and the mud up at the back of the harbour. So two different, totally different tours, and I guess totally different spiels and stories, Stinker.
Oh, entirely, entirely. I mean, the most interesting part of the West Harbour, I find, is the history of the AA Company. Now, I'm not going to go all through everything, but it was 1 million acres in 1824. It's now 200 years. They're celebrating 200 years of the AA Company, which still exists today. But if you're interested in that history, check out the AA Company. You'll get quite a surprise. And it was in England, of course, in 1824, that they decided that they were going to open up certain places in Australia. And this was Port Stephens. At the back of Port Stephens, a little place called Carrington and Tarlee, and 1 million acres. That's a lot of country. And, of course, they had sheep and cattle and horses. But it never worked all that well because it was the wrong country for sheep. So they had to go further up into the Hunter Valley. Up around Stroud, they found better country for sheep. And it's a very, very lucrative company, the AA Company. So have a look at it. Check it out. It's very interesting.
Yeah, you've got plenty to talk about. And where were the folk from, Stinker? Where were the people on board from?
Oh, well, a mixture of locals and visitors, but there was a bus arrived from Port Macquarie, and they were wonderful people. We had a really good yarn. I make a special effort to get around the boats and to sit down with a group and have a yarn and learn where they came from and what they've learnt and what they hope to learn and any questions that they want to ask. I try my hardest to answer them. Yeah, but I'm just enjoying meeting people. And I'll tell you what, Scott, there's a lot that listen to this program, a lot of them. Most of them do. Most of the people on board the boats on both days listen to this program.
Well, our Hastings River and Camden Haven and Kempsey correspondent, Cole the Waymaster Trenneman, will feature prominently next week because I'm going off for a big fish with Trenno. We're going to fish between the Manning and the Mighty McClay, and they'll get some on-the-water reports next week on how we go, Stinker.
Well, you're on the right track, Scott. If you want to learn about any area, you go to someone who knows the area very well, a successful fisherman like Trenno, and you say, do you mind if I come fishing, mate? And then you watch Michael Hawk, and he, of course, knows Scott. You know, that's his. If I went up there, I wouldn't have a clue. And probably if Trenno come here, he wouldn't know much either. It's your, what we used to be called, your own dunghill. Own dunghill.
You can't beat that local knowledge, Stinker, and you've got plenty of it, and you don't want to go anywhere else. Hey, well done for getting all those Port Macquarie people home safe and sound too, Stinker. It's great that you've been able to impart some wonderful knowledge, and they all had a great day.
Oh, and the weather was good. We had a bit of drizzle on Thursday, but it was not. It was beautiful. The weather was great. The sea was calm. There was so much to see. We saw sharks and heaps of dolphins. And inside and outside the port, different dolphins. The dolphins inside the port are bottlenose dolphin, and the ones on the outside, and they're a smaller dolphin, what's called a common dolphin. But it's people love to see dolphins. They'll all rush to one side of the boat and something it doesn't tip over.
Very big boat. Yeah, that's great. And you organise that too, don't you? You talk to them and say you've got to turn up at that time.
Oh, yeah. You know, I've been doing it for quite a while now and I enjoy it immensely.
Great to talk to you, Stinker. And next time, take a rod.
Yeah. I should have at least dragged a towed a lure anyway. Just let, get someone to hang on. Yeah. Toss out the lure and a handle on and say, here, hold on to that.
Good idea. Hey, tight lines, mate. We'll catch you next week.
Hooray, Scott.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Somewhere in the deep blue sea, right down deep at the bottom of the ocean, is a boy who's just waiting for a little money kid. And when he sees me in my wetsuit and my real cute flippers, he's gonna know that I'm the girl for him. 'Cause somewhere Big Fish Joe. Well, I'm sitting here, just sitting by the bay. I'm sitting here, just sitting by the bay. I'm gonna catch it, catch that fish today. Big Fish Joe. Well, I'm looking here, I'm looking everywhere. Yeah, I'm looking here, I'm looking everywhere. Well, he don't want me, man, that fish don't care. Well, I got no rhyme, I got no reason. Got no vision, big fish season. Make my hook, plan my dinner. Big Fish Joe.
It's the big fish and the president of the newest chapter of Ausfish Unlimited, the great fish conservation and habitat restoration charity, David Witham from the Central Coast. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Scott. How are you going?
Yeah, going well. Of course, you're in Santa's lair there. You're in the tackle shop. It's just a wonderful place to do your Christmas shopping, isn't it?
It's definitely hotting up, that's for sure, Scott.
Yeah, I tell you what's hard to find. I really do like a 1 to 3 kilo, 7-foot-plus rod that's a little stiffer and much lighter, because the jig heads that I'm using at the moment for flathead and my son's having some great success are 1/6. So they're smaller, they're more natural. Yep. There's some great little mullet paddle tails at the moment, aren't they? And you put a bit of scent on them, they look so much like the mullet of the estuary. I do like natural presentation as a fly fisherman, don't you? I mean, even when I'm doing my lure fishing, I like something that looks like the real thing.
Yeah, definitely. I always go for natural colours. I do a little bit of airbrushing lures and stuff like that, and I always go for the natural colours.
You'll even modify them slightly with the paints.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
These hobbies overlap, don't they? If you're a model builder or a train model nut, then you've got all that stuff that you could actually modify any lure, wood or plastic, to the colour scheme of your choice.
Yeah, definitely. A little bit of sandpaper to get the old varnish off and away you go. So it's fun.
I feel more confident with something that looks like a potty mullet or looks like a prawn, or a small squid, looks like the stuff that's in that estuary that I'm actually fishing in. I don't know if it makes any difference. You know, many people will go for nuclear chicken or chartreuse bright pink, and you think, there's nothing down there like that.
No, but, the old saying, if it ain't chartreuse, it ain't no use. So, I still tie the old chartreuse and white clouser for that reason. So,
absolutely, yes. I've caught some great kingies on those in Sydney Harbour. They just love that colour, don't they, with the dumbbell eyes. It's a good fly too, for a very good multi-purpose fly, the big clouser, isn't it? Because the hook point rides up as well, so you can fish it in the sandy estuaries for flathead quite well.
Yeah, and, you know, it's amazing the species that'll take a clouser. I mean, anything that eats a bait fish will take a clouser. I mean, I've caught over 200 species on fly, and a fair percentage of those will be on clousers. So,
yeah, and you just tie them to suit the size. I remember one of the Central Coast fly rodders outings that you were on, one of the members caught a huge bully mullet in Tugra Lakes on a clouser. You know, that was a great fight.
Yeah.
So
they
will often take flies. It happens too often to be just a fluke, doesn't it?
Well, it's certain times of the year too. I know, especially when mullet are spawning, they're a lot more likely to take a fly. You throw a small crazy Charlie or something like that at it, and they're more likely to take it.
Yeah.
They're a lot of fun too. They're like hooking a salmon, the bully mullet.
Oh, they go like crazy. I hooked one on one of those tiny little excess, super shallow running little chubby crankbaits that have been really good fun, and they've got really sharp sticky hooks, and I chucked it up into the mangroves, and this thing walloped it, and I thought, what is this? Is it a little dewy? It looked like a little dewy, and I thought, no, this must be a big EP, estuary perch, and when I got it near the boat after a cracking fight on 4-pound line, it turned out to be a 6-pound bully mullet with the lure right down in its mouth. And such a beautiful creature. I let it go, but those lures that are in the prawn colour, I love those as well. For the bigger fish, I believe that there are some huge paddle tails doing the rounds. What sort of jig heads would you use on those? Because people are catching some great mulloway. The mulloway have been good after all the rain, haven't they?
So there's some paddle tails that come out, like 9-inch long paddle tails, and in various jewfish colours, including a mullet sort of colour. They fish them either pre-rig, because you can buy them pre-rig now, or on sort of jig heads between a quarter and an ounce, depending on the depth of the water they're fishing.
Yeah. I guess you don't want it too heavy, but they do sit in the deep holes in the rivers. And let's put your Ausfish hat on, because it's a great organisation, and there seem to be chapters springing up everywhere. I was talking to Peachy the other day up on the Hawkesbury about Bass Sydney becoming an incorporated Ausfish chapter, because they really were doing the same work, weren't they?
That's right.
Repairing.
Yeah, it was very much an overlap up there. So it made sense to sort of fold it into one and, you know, share the same resource pool, because we all rely on volunteers. So the more volunteers we can get, the more we can get done. So.
And your Central Coast chapter of AusFish, the last time we spoke, you were putting on a big Gone Fishing Day right on the water near the sailing club at Brisbane Water in Gosford, right in the heart of Gosford. And they turned up in droves. I believe they caught some really good fish too.
Yeah, absolutely. So that we were there, the DPI team were there, and some of the kids turned up, and I was amazed at some of the flathead they were getting just standing on the rocks and casting a bait out. So, it was a really good day. Weather smiled on us, which was good, and really good participation. It was great to see so many young people there trying to learn about fishing and really getting into it. And you know, once they hook a fish like that, they're into it for life, which is really good to see.
All they need to learn a few knots, and they're away, aren't they?
Yeah, and that's exactly what we were doing at the AusFish stand. We had some sheets there with how to tie the different knots to attach jig heads or mono to braid and all that sort of stuff. And the kids were getting right into it. We had a little competition to see who could tie the strongest knot. So that's the sort of stuff we encourage, because the better the knot tying, the less mono there is in the estuary system after losing a fish or your jig head or whatever coming off. So.
Yeah, very good point. It's The Big Fish. We're speaking with Dave Witham, president of the Central Coast chapter of AusFish Unlimited, the newest chapter in New South Wales. And any habitat restoration work in the diary for next year around the Central Coast?
Yeah, we've got quite a bit coming up, and we're going to try and punch as much of it in the warmer months as we can. There's some invasive weeds starting to make its way into Brisbane waters. So one of the first things we're going to try and do probably in February is get on the snorkel and mask and flippers and dive down and try and remove some of that weed along the foreshore at Cooleywong. So that's probably going to be the first cab off the rank for next year. We've got funding for Pimp My Jetty. So that's... we'll kick that off early in the year. That's probably a thing that'll run all year. First step of that, of course, is to find people that are willing for us to put stuff under their jetty and encourage weed and oyster growth. So that's going to start with a letterbox drop early in the new year. And the interesting thing with that one is the funding actually has come directly from donations. So the more people donate, the better... the better we can improve the habitat. So as well as that, we've got the carp muster, which will happen again at the end of March. And we'll kick that off at the Wyong Milk Factory on the, I think it's the 27th of March, so the last weekend in March. And that'll run for 3 weeks. Well over 200 fish caught last year, so we're expecting a similar sort of thing this year. And it's amazing how many fish there are in the freshwater waterways on the Central Coast.
One of the great fisher folk that we know, Big Bob Williams, who actually was part of the very first broadcast from ABC Central Coast, where I work when I'm not doing The Big Fish for the statewide program, with James O'Loughlin. And he was spent a fascinating 10 minutes or so talking to James O'Loughlin, who was doing the nighttime program at that stage, about chasing mulloway on fly. He's been doing it a bit tough with his health of late.
Yeah, he hasn't been great, and, we're trying to all rally around and support him as much as we can. But, you know, Bob was definitely one of the pioneers in saltwater fly, and certainly unheralded. He's a very humble man. He never put himself out there like a lot of people do, and, you know, never got onto social media or any of that sort of stuff. But, yeah, Jewfish on fly, I remember working with him to get Drummer on fly. His lure, brim lure fishing down the Hawkesbury River when, you know, they kicked off the fishing the oyster racks down on the Hawkesbury on lure. That was Bob again. So he's really made a big impact in terms of the sort of fishing we do now on the Central Coast.
Yeah, big shout out to Big Bob. Good to talk to you again, David.
Yep, you too, Scott. Anytime, just, you know where I am.
Yeah, I think we might need to have a bit of a Christmas fish over the break too.
Yeah, well, we can certainly arrange something.
Tight lines, buddy.
Good on you, Scott. Have a good day.
There's David Witham, the president of the Central Coast branch of AusFish Unlimited, a very keen fly fisherman, very keen lure fisherman, very keen bait fisherman. On the Big Fish. Catch you next week.
Oh, get out of it, bloody seagulls.